I next met with Dr. Martin Reck from the Lugin Clinic in Gross-Hansdorf, Germany, to get his take on the current role of immunotherapy in non-small cell lung cancer. And to begin, he commented on the use of checkpoint inhibitors in metastatic disease.
We have seen the superiority of pembrolizumab in a selected group, 30% of the patients with a high PD-L1 expression on the tumor. So the question is how to deal with the rest. Are we able to increase the efficacy of chemotherapy? Are we able to increase the immunogenicity of the tumor? And this has been the backbone of the combination trials. And we do have, number one, combination trials for patients with squamous cell histology. We have the KEYNOTE-407 and we have the IMpower131. Both are trials investigating a combination of chemotherapy with a checkpoint inhibitor. In KEYNOTE-407, we had pembrolizumab. In the IMpower trial, we had atezolizumab. And in both trials, the primary endpoint has been progression-free survival as well as overall survival. While KEYNOTE-407 was reported at the ASCO meeting, and we have seen a significant improvement in progression-free survival and overall survival favoring the combination of platinum-based chemotherapy and pembrolizumab, and this improvement was independent from the PD-L1 expression status. So we have seen this improvement also in the group of patients with PD-L1 negative tumors. Well, in the other trial, in the IMpower131, we also have seen a significant improvement in progression-free survival. But so far, we haven't seen any improvement in overall survival favoring the combination of chemotherapy and atezolizumab. We have to be a little bit cautious because we only have seen the data of an interim analysis, and we will see more mature data by autumn of this year. But so far, we can see for squamous cell non-small cell lung cancer, there is an improvement of efficacy by the addition of immunotherapy to platinum-based chemotherapy. And this is of substantial importance because for decades, we haven't seen any improvement in squamous cell non-small cell lung cancer. The second part is non-squamous non-small cell lung cancer. This is the largest group of patients, and there we have two major trials. One is the KEYNOTE-189, combining pembrolizumab to platinum pemetrexed. Again, co-primary endpoint, overall survival and progression-free survival, significant improvement of both endpoints. Progression-free survival and overall survival hazard ratio of 0.5. And again, this benefit has been seen independent from the PD-L1 expression status. The other trial, looking on non-squamous non-small cell lung cancer eligible for bevacizumab, has been IMpower 150. And in IMpower 150, the old ECOG schedule, carboplatin, paclitaxel, and bevacizumab, was compared to a quadruplet, to a four-drug combination of carboplatin, paclitaxel, bevacizumab, and atezolizumab. And we have seen in two analyses that progression-free survival and overall survival also was significantly improved in favor of the atezolizumab-containing regimen. There were some very interesting data coming from the IMpower 150. Number one was the fact that this improved efficacy was also seen in an unfavorable group of patients. And these were patients with liver metastasis. And the other group was the group of patients with pretreated oncogenic alterations like EGF receptor mutations. So also in this group, there was a significant improvement in progression-free survival and overall survival favoring the combination of immunotherapy, anti-angiogenic treatment, and chemotherapy. And lastly, we were talking about the immunotherapy combination. This has been tested in the CheckMate 227. So the combination of ipilimumab and nivolumab against platinum-based chemotherapy. And there we have seen that in a subgroup of patients, and 40% of the patients who have a high tumor mutational burden on their tumor, there is indeed a significant improvement in progression-free survival favoring the combination of ipilimumab and nivolumab compared to platinum-based chemotherapy. And our challenge now will be to identify the best combination for the individual patient. So this will be the challenge for the future.
Okay, well, that's what I want to try to dissect out for you. in terms of kind of like what you're doing or what you would like to do based on the data, I'm going to go through a bunch of things that are, you know, pretty obvious, really, in terms of questions and subsets. But one just general question about the combination trials in both squamous, non-squamous in general. Do we have much information about whether the patients who were randomized to chemo got IOs on relapse?
There was, let's say, in half of the trials, there was the opportunity to cross over. So, for example, in the KEYNOTE 189, there was the opportunity to cross over to pembrolizumab in case that the patients had received placebo. This was not foreseen in each trial. However, when you look on the data of post-progression therapy, there is a substantial group of patients in each trial who received post-progression immunotherapy.
Because, you know, it really introduces a concept that you see throughout oncology. It started in breast cancer, where initially they were using combinations, and now they wanted to use single agents. And then we heard a lot of discussion in myeloma about, do you pile everything on together or give it sequentially? I know it seems, you know, they're different diseases, but from an oncologist's point of view, it kind of has similar. And I guess the same question here, you know, when you talk about giving this, theoretically, you're saying it's better than waiting. So either there's a synergy between the chemotherapy and the IO, or maybe the patient, you know, gets too sick and gets too far behind, or maybe there's genetic evolution. What do you think explains the survival benefit?
Well, I think it's the interaction. It's
really
clearly a specific interaction between chemotherapy and immunotherapy. Well, I have to tell you that we really have a rapid disclosure of all of these data. So we do see interim analysis. I think we have to wait for the follow-up analysis. And what we would like to see is this plateau of long-term overall survival, because this is the substantial benefit which is of value for the individual patient. So far, we only can see we have a hazard ratio. There is a benefit, it's clear, but I think the real value will come out by the longer follow-up when we see the two-year overall survival rates, when we are talking about the three-year overall survival rates, and when we really can identify a plateau of efficacy for these patients.
But you think there's a synergy, and you think there's a synergy in terms of long-term benefit?
Long-term benefit, yes. So we had the same discussion when we started with the EGF receptor TKIs and the mutated patients. So we had a response rate of more than 70%, and we said, are we curing the patient? But after 2 years, we had to identify relapse in that disease. So it's still metastatic disease, but we have an extremely good control. And I think this is the major goal of our treatment, that we are able to control the disease and to provide the patient with a good quality of life.
So another question, kind of working my way back through practical realities, is the issue of the patient with a targetable mutation, EGFR, ALK, BRAF, et cetera, the non-smoker. And up until recently, I was hearing investigators say, we're delaying IOs in those patients until they've at least had chemo once, maybe more than once. And then I think it was only recently, like at ASCO, I started to hear people talking about, okay, yeah, they're going to get their targeted therapy as long as it works, first line, second line. But once that's over, it's going to be chemo plus an IO. Is that where we are with that?
So I think this is the result of IMpower 150. Because in all the combination trials, patients with targetable alterations were excluded. So in the KEYNOTE trials and all the other immunotherapy trials, CheckMate 227, these patients were clearly excluded because we know that IO monotherapy does not work in that group of patients with oncogenic alterations. I have to say, because I'm the PI of IMpower 150, I was quite surprised when I did observe this result coming out of IMpower 150 describing the increased efficacy even in the group of patients with pretreated oncogenic alterations.
But, and again, these patients that had targeted therapy.
Yes, they were pretreated. So if they were eligible for IMpower 150, they had a previous treatment with at least one line of targeted therapy. So we do not have any information how many lines of targeted therapies did they receive. We even do not know the molecular status, whether they had a T790M mutation, yes or not. But we had documented that each of these patients had received at least one line of targeted therapies before they were randomized in the IMpower 150.
These were what, mainly EGFR?
Yes, the majority. We had few patients with ALK. We had the same signal also for the ALK patients, but I have to tell you that this is rather exploratory, the hazard ratio, the confidence interval. These were very, very few patients, so we will need additional data for this group of patients. But I think the concept of combining anti-angiogenic treatment and IO is quite fascinating, even in particular for those patients with EGF receptor mutations who progress and who do not have a T790M mutation as a resistance mutation. So, for example, we are entering now the area where we have the first-line ORA data. Osimertinib is available as a first-line treatment. And currently, we do not have any idea what to do if a patient progresses after osimertinib. And this could be a very interesting opportunity for those patients receiving the combination of IO anti-angiogenic treatment and perhaps a little bit of chemotherapy.
When you say a little bit of chemotherapy, what exactly?
Well, the data are generated for IMpower 150. This is a full-dose chemotherapy with carboplatin paclitaxel. But we have to realize this is also an exhausting schedule. And a patient who already had received perhaps 2 years of osimertinib and had some deterioration of the performance status may be not eligible for this exhausting four-drug combination. So I think we have to work on the chemotherapy schedule. And personally, I do not believe that each patient really needs the full dose of this chemotherapy. We need the impact of the chemotherapy. But I think perhaps we can achieve this with a modified dose or modified schedule of cytotoxic drugs.
What about, I mean, obviously you have the pembrocarbo possibility, but what about nab-paclitaxel and carboplatin?
Well, this is also very attractive. So we have seen in squamous that the data are quite good. And we know there is a press release for another combination trial with immunotherapy using the combination of carbo and nab-paclitaxel. We are going to see the results in one of the autumn meetings, either World Lung or ESMO. And I think this is also a quite good backbone chemotherapy for the combination with checkpoint inhibitors.
So when we talk about management then of patients with targetable mutations who, you know, you're going to kind of consider as a group, I guess you would include EGFR, ALK, ROS1, BRAF. What else would you include? RET at this point? HER2? How do you break them down into, you know, this phenotype where you're rethinking IOs? And so which targetable things are we talking about? And what's the role, if any, of PD-L1 levels? I've heard that some of these patients, like with ALK, have PD-L1 and don't respond. Does TMB fit into these patients? How do you see all these the targetable patients in terms of IOs and tissue assays?
So I would concentrate on the four major alterations, which is EGF, ALK, ROS1, and BRAF. We have very few data on RET. We have very few data on MET14 skipping, and there's one alteration which is clearly different, that is KRAS, which is the most frequent molecular alteration in lung cancer. We do know that KRAS does not respond to any targeted therapy, but we have data that they might respond to immunotherapy. So I would separate KRAS from the four others, which are EGF, ALK, ROS1, and BRAF. So for these four alterations, in each time, I would start with a targeted therapy and I would normally offer them a chemotherapy at time of relapse. But now we have this perhaps new opportunity to offer them the combination of immunotherapy and chemotherapy. Coming back to the question of the PD-L1 expression, it's true. There are patients with an ALK translocation and a 90% PD-L1 expression on the tumor cells. And I also have seen patients with an EGF receptor mutation and a high PD-L1 level. But we have some data that suggest that the PD-L1 expression in this type of oncogenic alterated tumor is different from the PD-L1 expression from a non-oncogenic alterated tumor with regard of the biological importance and the biological impact on tumor proliferation. So we have seen, even in patients with an EGF receptor mutation and a high PD-L1 expression, only a very minor response to a treatment with a checkpoint inhibitor. So we really have to say the oncogenic alteration is the major finding. The PD-L1 expression is a secondary finding, but it's not comparable to the PD-L1 expression in a non-oncogenic alterated tumor.
So in a younger patient, you know, the non-smoker, the EGFR, et cetera, would you consider also looking at tumor mutation burden? And you know, I want you to imagine you have a formulary of any drug you want. Just forget regulatory issues. Would you look at tumor mutation burden? Let's say a patient who's progressing on osimertinib, okay? Would you look at tumor mutation burden? Would you look at PD-L1? And if you were going to offer them a combination, what exact agents would you like to use?
Well, if she is progressing on osimertinib and I have no clear targetable alteration, I would like to give her a combination of checkpoint inhibitor and chemotherapy. Currently, the only data which are available are for the combination of atezolizumab and platinum-based chemotherapy. So I would go for the schedule. But whether or whether not she has a tumor mutational burden, I think in that situation, that doesn't help me. I think independent from any tumor mutational burden or PD-L1 expression, I would offer this young patient the combination of immunotherapy and chemotherapy.
And again, atezolizumab, carbo, and what?
Yes, currently I would go for paclitaxel or nab-paclitaxel.
And what about bevacizumab?
Yes, I would try it. So I think this is something of the secret of the data, that the combination of atezolizumab and bevacizumab was in that schedule that has been used in the EMPOWER 150. So I would try to give the patient this four-drug combination, atezolizumab, bevacizumab, and carboplatin with paclitaxel or nab-paclitaxel.
Okay, now let's just talk about non-squamous cancers without genomic alterations. How do you approach those? And ever since the combination data has come out, we always talk about a patient who's not that symptomatic, a patient who's very symptomatic, and same situations in an older patient.
Well, PD-L1 assay would be part of my first diagnostic procedure. It's very easy. It's immune histochemistry. You get it in 2 days. And if there is a high PD-L1 expression, I clearly would favor a monotherapy with pembrolizumab. It's better tolerable. We have seen durable responses over years following that treatment.
So by high, though, you mean 50%?
Over 50%, more than 50%.
Okay. So before you come off that, again, putting aside regulatory issues, what about 40%, 35% in an older patient?
Well, older patient, no objection to use pembrolizumab in a group of high-expressing tumors. Lower percentage of PD-L1 expression, 30%, 40%. In reality, either you have a high expression or you have something like a very low expression. So you do see that kind of patients very rarely. But I would go for a combination with platinum and pembrolizumab and pemetrexed. And I have to say that the combination of KEYNOTE-189 is very attractive for this group of patients. It's very easy. Carboplatin pemetrexed as a backbone chemotherapy. And we have seen a very interesting or a very impressive signal of efficacy.
Again, putting aside regulatory considerations, what about the patient with a PD-L1 of 0?
Again, this would be one candidate for combination chemotherapy and immunotherapy. Well, we have now two opportunities. So we have the KEYNOTE schedule, which is platinum pemetrexed and pembrolizumab. And we have the EMPOWER schedule, and we will get more schedules by end of the year. So I think the specific advantage or the specific result coming out from EMPOWER 150 has been the high response rate, We had a response rate of 60% and has been the specific activity on the group of patients with liver metastasis. And I think this is a surrogate marker for patients with a high tumor burden, fast progressing tumors. We know that bevacizumab can improve response, can improve progression-free survival. So if I have a patient with a high tumor burden, fast progressing tumor, this would be the patients where I would try to combine chemotherapy, bevacizumab, and atezolizumab.
So I'm just going to, one more thing, which is, again, going back to the PD-L1 zero patient, and you said that you wouldn't really look at tumor mutation burden, but suppose somebody had done the tumor mutation burden, it was high.
Yes, so I think this is a very important question. If we have a patient with PD-L1 zero, I think there is a role for the assessment of tumor mutational burden, because we know if tumor mutational burden is low and PD-L1 is zero, the combination of chemotherapy and immunotherapy does not add a lot to chemotherapy alone. So therefore, tumor mutational burden seems to be quite a good descriptional marker. And if there is a high tumor mutational burden in a tumor which is clearly PD-L1 negative, the immunotherapy combination would be my favorite. So I would offer him nivolumab and ipilimumab if there are no contraindications.
Right. Okay, well, now let's talk about metastatic squamous. Same thing, older, younger, symptomatic, asymptomatic, but particularly PD-L1 levels and exactly what you would like to do.
Well, for squamous, the first step is the same. Looking on the PD-L1 level, if it's high, this is a candidate for pembrolizumab mono. If it's in between, this would be a combination candidate. Chemotherapy with pembrolizumab, currently, these are the best data that we have. If we have PD-L1 zero, we have the KEYNOTE-407. This was carboplatin, nab-paclitaxel or paclitaxel plus or minus pembrolizumab. And this is the trial which showed an improvement in progression-free survival and overall survival. So in this group of in-between patients, clearly the combination would be my favorite. In the group of negatives, if there is a sign of tumor mutational burden, if there is a high tumor mutational burden, again, I also would consider to use the combination of nivolumab and ipilimumab, because this tumor mutational burden is completely independent from histology. So we do see this in non-squamous as well as in squamous cell histology.
Could you walk through a little bit more about that trial specifically and what they looked at, what they found, and also what they saw in terms of toxicity with ipi-nivo combination in patients with lung cancer? Obviously, it's been used with melanoma a lot.
Yes. So the combination of nivolumab and ipilimumab was prospectively investigated in the CheckMate 227. And this was a rather large, huge trial. These were more than 1,000 patients, and we had one cohort of PD-L1 positive tumors and one large cohort of PD-L1 negative tumors. And primarily, the question was whether the combination of ipilimumab and nivolumab is superior to platinum-based chemotherapy. So this was investigated in the PD-L1 positive and in the PD-L1 negative tumors. And we had two co-primary endpoints. So far, we only have seen one of them. So the first co-primary endpoint has been overall survival in the PD-L1 positive tumor. So we are still waiting for these results. But perhaps more importantly, the second co-primary endpoint was progression-free survival in the group of patients with high tumor mutational burden. And here we have seen a clear benefit favoring the combination of ipilimumab and nivolumab. Looking on tolerability, well, we have seen, let's say, constitutional toxicities, we have seen GI toxicities, and we also have seen other toxicities associated with the combination of nivolumab and ipilimumab. And the majority of this side effect is related to the dose of ipilimumab. So we have done a lot of work reducing the dose of ipilimumab. Currently, we are using 1 milligram every 6 weeks. And with that dose, we could lower the frequency of CTC-3 and 4, which means clinically relevant adverse events, down to 31%. And this is quite consistent across all trials using the combination of ipilimumab and nivolumab in patients with advanced non-small cell lung cancer. We have to be aware this is a specific toxicity, and we have to educate the doctors, we have to educate the patients. If there are any signs of GI toxicity, really to contact the doctor. But for the majority of the patients, this combination seems to work very well.
Let's talk a little bit about locally advanced disease, because at the ESMO meeting last fall, we saw the PACIFIC study, a major phase 3 study looking at checkpoint inhibitor durvalumab in the consolidation setting after chemoradiation. Really, I mean, to me, it was like an adjuvant trial and changed practice in a second. It seemed like it anyhow. Can you go through kind of the background for that study, what they looked at, what they found, and what you think it means?
Well, this really has a groundbreaking trial. It's true. It's the question of consolidation treatment after chemoradiotherapy in stage 3 non-small cell lung cancer. And this is an area where we haven't seen any progress for more than 15 years. So the only improvement and management of this group of patients has been the introduction of simultaneous chemoradiotherapy. Well, the concept was very simple. So patients with locally advanced non-small cell lung cancer received chemoradiotherapy. If they were doing well, they were randomized to immunotherapy with durvalumab, or they were randomized to placebo. And there were two co-primary endpoints, which were progression-free survival, and the other one was overall survival. And so far, we only have seen the progression-free survival. This was impressively improved in favor of those patients who received durvalumab as a consolidation treatment. We even have seen an improvement in response after receiving chemoradiotherapy. And we have seen a significant prolongation of the time to metastasis, which is a very clinically relevant endpoint. Now, looking on tolerability, we have been very afraid of using immunotherapy in this setting of patients because there is the risk of lung toxicity. But when you select the patients and when you look on the data of the PACIFIC trial, the incidence rate of pulmonary toxicity related to durvalumab was very, very low. And now we have seen that there is a second press release that the trial also met the secondary co-primary endpoint of overall survival. So we do not only have a significant improvement in progression-free survival, we have an improvement in overall survival. We are going to see the data on one of the fall meetings, probably on the World Lung Cancer in Toronto. And this really would mark a substantial improvement in the management of stage 3 non-small cell lung cancer.
So I'm kind of curious, just, you know, you're theoretically, why do you think we're seeing this benefit? You know, kind of reminds what you were talking before about, you know, metastatic disease. Is it 1+1=2? Is there some synergy? Are you a believer in the abscopal effect? What do you think's going on?
So I'm not really a believer in the abscopal effect, but I'm a believer that the combination of chemotherapy and radiotherapy is one of the strongest inductors of immune activation of the tumor. So we do not only have chemotherapy with the mechanical destruction of the tumor cells, we have the local radiotherapy, which also has a pro-immunogenic effect on the tumor. And I think the combination of both of these therapeutic modalities has a very strong impact on the efficacy of immunotherapy. And this is also seen. Let's say that there was one interesting subgroup result coming out of the PACIFIC trial that the efficacy seems to be independent from the PD-L1 expression status. So we did observe the improvement in progression-free survival in the group of patients with high PD-L1 expression as well as in the group of patients with low PD-L1 expression.
And again, the issue of targetable mutations came out, and they looked at that. They had patients in the trial, and it looked like they benefited also.
There was a benefit. We have to be cautious because the group was very, very small and the confidence interval is quite broad. It's an exploratory signal, but it's true there was a signal of efficacy even in that group of patients with targetable mutations. Normally, we do not look for these mutations in that group of patients, stage 3 non-small cell lung cancer, but there was a signal of efficacy.
So from what I've seen in terms of, you know, asking investigators, surveying investigators, it seems like people have flipped over into this being the standard of care in general. I mean, there are exceptions to every rule, but is that the way you see it?
Yes, clearly. So this completely will change management. This will be an additional opportunity. We are now in the next step. So our question would be, if we have this tremendous effect in consolidation, what about moving immunotherapy a little bit earlier and together with the chemoradiotherapy? So we currently are performing trials investigating the combination of immunotherapy and radiotherapy, investigating the combination of chemoradiotherapy and immunotherapy, and we are generating our first signals of efficacy and perhaps more importantly, our first signals of tolerability.
And, you know, I don't know how many neoadjuvant IO alone trials there have been, but I know there was one that came out of Memorial where they had patients who actually had resectable lung cancer and they gave them an IO pre-op and they saw pretty interesting benefit. What about just using an IO before chemo radiation? I don't know, to bulk reduce or see what happens, particularly if you have a high PD-L1 level.
I think it's interesting. I think that there are a lot of trials going on coming from radiotherapy to determine the optimal timing of radiotherapy and immunotherapy. So I think it seems to matter how you deliver radiotherapy and immunotherapy and what schedule you deliver these two treatment modalities to the patient. Coming to the neoadjuvant trial, this has been really also quite exciting. The patients received 2 shots of nivolumab within 6 weeks, and the radiologic response was not so impressive. It was 10%, but they had a pathological response in more than 40% of the patients, and this is quite a very important signal. So we are now trying to understand the signals. There are more trials ongoing investigating neoadjuvant immunotherapy or neoadjuvant immunochemotherapy, but this is clearly the area where indeed we are hoping to increase the number of cured patients, the cure rate of non-small cell lung cancer.
Right. What you were saying about the, quote, response, I guess it seemed like there were tumors that maybe didn't shrink or shrink enough radiologically, but then when they looked pathologically, there was no viable tissue.
Indeed. This was the major finding.
And have there been any other data sets other than that Memorial one that were similar to that?
So far, not. So I know that by autumn we will see more data sets, but so far I haven't seen any more data sets which have been published.
And again, just getting back to pragmatics. So if you have a patient who's locally advanced disease, maybe they're a non-smoker, they've got EGFR mutation or ALK, for example, are you going to offer durvalumab?
Yes, I clearly would. Because in stage 3, we do not clearly know the efficacy of targeted therapies. There seems to be a difference between metastatic and locally advanced disease. And in that case, I clearly would offer, even with an EGF receptor mutation, those patients durvalumab as a consolidation treatment.
So let's talk a little bit about toxicity. You mentioned the concern that was out there initially about pulmonary toxicity, which we didn't see. But the truth is, you might see pulmonary toxicity just from chemo radiation. And maybe, I don't know, have you found that there are situations where you're not sure, you know, patients having some kind of pneumonitis, maybe exacerbated COPD, whatever, and you're not sure whether it's durvalumab or not?
Well, I think this is one of the difficulties of PACIFIC, because only patients without any severe signs of pulmonary toxicity following chemoret were eligible to go to randomization. So this was a positive selection of patients.
But I mean, couldn't you develop pulmonary toxicity later though, theoretically?
Yes, but the percentage of patients who develop late onset radiotoxicity is very, very small. And then it's really very hard to differentiate. So we also have seen this severe pulmonary toxicity in a group of patients receiving placebo. And this clearly was pulmonary toxicity as a late onset coming from chemoradiotherapy. The percentage was low, but it is there. But I think we cannot differentiate this from immunotherapy-related pulmonary toxicity, because they can have each figure of interstitial toxicity that you can see on the CT scan.
So we could go on for a long time, but I really love these cases. I'd like to ask you about them briefly, beginning with your 69-year-old man with mesothelioma.
And yes.
I'd like to kind of find out what's new with mesothelioma, and particularly what about checkpoint inhibitors. Well, let's talk about what happened with this man briefly.
Well, this was, as you mentioned, 69, a male patient with advanced mesothelioma. It was an epithelioid mesothelioma, and he received three different types of chemotherapy. So we started with cisplatinum pemetrexed, then he received platinum vinorelbine, platinum gemcitabine, and then he was progressing. This was at the end of 2016. And I think I had some difficulties, and I had the opportunity to offer him immunotherapy with pembrolizumab. And we have seen that there are some data on mono activity of pembrolizumab, and he had a tremendous response following the treatment with pembrolizumab. It was a better response compared to the response that we have seen with chemotherapy. And it was a long-lasting response, so he responded for more than 1 year following that immunotherapy.
Did he have a PD-L1 level?
No. We had looked for, but the pathologist told me that he was not able to determine the PD-L1 expression level. It's sometimes very difficult in mesothelioma to get an accurate information on the PD-L1 level. So we hadn't any PD-L1 level for this patient.
You know, you would think if any cancer, you know, would have a high tumor mutation burden, it'd be mesothelioma, but does it?
Well, there are very few information about TMB in mesothelioma. It's not a smoking-associated tumor that much. It's an asbestos-related tumor. And we know that you can find each targetable mutation in the tumor, but we do not have any targeted therapy available. It's a difficult tumor. We are not just starting to investigate this tumor, and hopefully we will get some data on tumor mutational burden in the near future. But so far, these data are quite unknown. What we do know is that besides pembrolizumab, we have seen quite impressive data also for the combination of nivolumab and ipilimumab coming from a French group investigating this combination. And this is something which is currently done in a phase 3 trial, comparing nivolumab, ipilimumab to platinum-based chemotherapy as a first-line therapy.
So right now, though, off protocol, well, if you could, again, putting aside regulatory issues, where would you integrate, what line therapy would you integrate a checkpoint inhibitor, and would you use it alone or in combination?
Well, it would be dependent on the patient. So if this is a patient in a good performance status without any contraindications, I would go for the immune combination. I perhaps would use it as a second line opportunity after chemotherapy, because currently we do not have any second line treatment available for a mesothelioma.
And in this patient, when you started the pembrolizumab, how much tumor, where was the tumor, and then how did it shrink exactly, and what happened to his symptoms?
So the symptoms were severe dyspnea. So there was substantial tumor.
Was he on oxygen?
No, but he was at the border of oxygen insufflation. So the O2 saturation was below 90%. And we did observe a more than 50% decrease of the tumor following 2 or 3 injections of pembrolizumab.
Fascinating. I see, though, that after a while he developed some what you thought was pneumonitis. What happened there?
Yes, so this was after 1 year, even more than 1 year of treatment, that on the regular CT scans, there were interstitial findings in the lung parenchyma, and there was also an association with some clinical symptoms, shortness of breath, and we stopped. So he received steroids, and he recovered, so we could give him pembrolizumab again after recovery of this lung toxicity.
Fascinating. Was he a smoker, and was he exposed to asbestos?
He was exposed to asbestos, but he was a never smoker.
Interesting. So he's currently back on pembrolizumab?
Currently, he had a second episode of his pulmonary toxicity at spring of this year, so we had to stop pembrolizumab again. Currently, he's on steroids, and we are following up.
So I want to hear about your couple other patients. I was really fascinated by this 63-year-old lady with polymyalgia rheumatica and arteritis temporalis. You know, we're starting to hear more and more, you know, about people who are coming in to immunotherapy with it or questioning immunotherapy with all kinds of prior autoimmune disease. I'm not sure I've heard about polymyalgia rheumatica. I'm really curious to know what happened there.
She's still on pembrolizumab and she's doing excellent. So this was a patient, she was diagnosed with a brain metastasis. So she had a seizure and the first diagnosis was done by the MRT of her brain. So she had brain metastasis and then we identified adenocarcinoma, no oncogenic alterations. She received first-line chemotherapy with a stabilization, platinum pemetrexed. She received second-line treatment following progression of the disease with docetaxel. We added nintedanib, which is a German opportunity. It's an angiokinase inhibitor. And then she progressed.
So that was about a year and a half ago. So before you talk about what happened when she went on the pembrolizumab, could you just backtrack a little bit and talk about her history with polymyalgia and how active it was at that time?
So she had pain in her arms and in her shoulders, and she was on treatment with prednisone at a dose which was between 5 milligram and 15 milligram per day.
And how long had she had this?
For 5 or 6 years already. So this was a pre-existing comorbidity, which was apparent even before she had the cancer diagnosis.
And to what extent were you concerned about it?
Well, obviously, when I started pembrolizumab, I was so glad to see that she was a high expressor. And I have to say that more or less I had overseen this comorbidity. So I started the treatment and I haven't been aware that she had this comorbidity. Coming back, well, I was not so, let's say, affected by this comorbidity because she was quite stable. She had a low dose of steroids. It was something between 5 and 10 milligrams at the time when I started pembrolizumab. And for me, it was a controlled autoimmune disease. And I said, well, we might see some flare-up with the start of pembrolizumab, but overall, I think it's controlled, and if there is going to happen something, we can increase the steroid dose, we can stop pembrolizumab, we have other opportunities. So it was an existing contraindication formally, but I was not really concerned about that. It's the same when we talk about rheumatological arthritis or other rheumatological diseases. I'm a little bit concerned when there is an autoimmune GI disease, like a colitis ulcerosa or a morbus Crohn. And I'm a little bit concerned when there is an autoimmune neurological disease. But for rheumatological diseases, I think if the patients are in good control, you can test the immunotherapy.
Although it's really interesting as I read about this case in terms of what happens, you wonder whether there may be other issues other than the concern about flaring up the autoimmune disease, but rather the nature of their immune system and immune response, because it looks like this lady had kind of an unusual response, let's say. What happened?
Yeah. So this was quite impressive, and I really was a little bit scared. So when I started, she really had a bulky tumor in the lung, and she received one dose of pembrolizumab, and she came back to my clinic really ill. She had a shortness of breath, she had fever, and she really said, well, I have a respiratory problem. And I performed an X-ray, I performed a CT scan, and there seemed to be a complete destruction of the tumor. And I was not very sure whether this is acute pulmonary toxicity induced by pembrolizumab, whether this is pneumonia or something else.
How high were her fevers?
So this was 38 degrees, 38, 38.5 in that range. It was an O2 saturation of less than 90%, so I had to give her oxygen. So this was really a critical situation.
But you actually wrote down here, quote, general septic reaction. Did she look septic?
Yes, yes. So she was really ill. And so I was really unsure how to proceed. So I went to my radiologist and we looked on the CT scans and we discussed this. And she said, well, personally, I do not believe that this is pulmonary toxicity. I do believe this is a pneumonia, and I gave her a very broad spectrum antibiotic, and I discussed with her how to proceed with immunotherapy. She had a very clear vision. She said, I want to stay on immunotherapy. It's my only chance. And if there's any opportunity, I would like to continue immunotherapy. And she had two very bad weeks, but after the treatment with antibiotics, she recovered. And then we could continue pembrolizumab. And on the CT scans to follow up, we did observe that it must have been some kind of acute reaction of the tumor following the treatment with pembrolizumab, leading to the septic reaction after the first dose of immunotherapy.
So do you think this is like sort of a massive tumor response and necrosis or some immune thing?
Yeah, indeed. I think this is something like we have seen in small cell lung cancer, the tumor lysis syndrome after one shot of chemotherapy. This reminds me a little bit of the reaction that I've seen in that patient.
I was going to ask you, did she have any biochemical manifestations of tumor lysis syndrome?
No. So with the exception of a high inflammation markers, I couldn't detect anything.
So she has this great response, but then I see she also has some exacerbation of her rheumatologic problems.
Yes. So this was then afterwards, and she had an increase in the pain of her shoulders and the muscles, and I had a lot of conversations with her rheumatologist. So we discussed the increase of the steroid dose. We continued the pembrolizumab. We increased the steroid dose. Now she's completely fine again. So the inflammation markers are going down. Now she has a steroid dose of 3 milligrams of prednisone. She is completely fine. So this has been some, let's say, interim aggravation of the disease, of the rheumatological disease, but we could control it.
You see what I was saying before, though, maybe somehow her response in the tumor in some way has something to do with her polymyalgia. You know what I mean? Like there's something about her immune system that's different. I don't know.
I think it would be interesting. So we are following this because there's one of the markers that we are looking for is the inflammatory signature of the tumor. And this seems to be really an inflammatory tumor with a high probability to respond to immunotherapies.
That's fascinating. Let's hear about a couple more of your patients, or at least one more. 61-year-old man with small cell. And looks like he had a lot of problems with GI issues with ipi-nivo. So I want to hear about that.
Yeah. So this was one of my patients coming from the CheckMate 451 trial, which is a trial looking on the efficacy of nivolumab and ipilimumab in the maintenance setting of small cell lung cancer. So patients are receiving platinum-based chemotherapy, and if there is a response, these patients are randomized to nivo, nivo-ipi, or a placebo. And this was a patient, extensive disease, small cell lung cancer, good response after platinum etoposide. He was randomized. Well, this must have been the combination of nivolumab and ipilimumab. So he got the first injection of the combination. I saw him 3 weeks later. He had some, let's say, very mild diarrhea. So I said, okay, this might be related to the immunotherapy. I prescribed loperamide according to the protocol. He came back and said, well, everything is fine. So he got the second shot. But then he got a very severe enterocolitis. And the problem was that this patient was not from my area. So he was coming from an area 200 kilometers from my center. So he was sent to another hospital. So I contacted the hospital and said, well, be aware, this patient had received an immunotherapy combination. This might be an immune-associated colitis, enterocolitis. You have to give him steroids. Perhaps you have to give him infliximab, but he never received this. And therefore, he had a very prolonged deterioration of this side effect. And I think it's very important. If we do see this substantial GI adverse events, we really have to give the patients the appropriate treatments to control the adverse events.
How often do you see colitis with just PD-1 or PD-L1 alone without the IPI? And how often do you end up using infliximab?
Well, so I think this was clearly related to the combination of ipilimumab and nivolumab. So I very, very rarely seen this associated with nivolumab. So ipilimumab is the driving factor for the GI toxicity. And we use infliximab in, let's say, few patients, less than 10% of our patients showing up with this enterocolitis. I think it is of importance to use high-dose steroids as early as possible. Then you have a chance to control the enterocolitis. And if this doesn't work, but you have to monitor the patient, then indeed you have to give them infliximab.
This 61-year-old lady, metastatic adenocarcinoma, no driver mutations, got carbo-pem and pembrolizumab, excellent response, goes on pembro-pemetrexed maintenance and develops renal toxicity. Curious about renal toxicity with pembro. What happened?
Well, this was a little bit, let's say, disappointing because we really had an outstanding response. She had a high tumor burden. She was stage 4 with metastasis in each organ, you could imagine. And we were quite happy to have this response following the first-line chemotherapy. And then she went on the maintenance, and by protocol, it was the combination of pembrolizumab and pemetrexed. And it was blinded in that way. It was for a KEYNOTE-189, but I unblinded her. So I know that she received pembrolizumab and pemetrexed. And then we did observe from injection to injection a slight decrease in the creatinine value. And there was one situation where there was a marked decrease in the renal function. And we stopped the maintenance treatment. First, we stopped the pemetrexed, but later on, we also stopped the pembrolizumab. I sent her to a nephrologist to go for a sample of the kidneys. He couldn't find anything. I gave her high-dose steroids. There we were able to improve the renal function by a bit, but there was a remaining decrease of the renal function following that maintenance treatment with pemetrexed and pembrolizumab.
So there was no nephritis or anything that looked autoimmune in the kidney?
Not really. He couldn't find anything. And I'm still not sure whether this is related to pemetrexed or pembrolizumab. So we have seen there was a number of patients with severe renal toxicity in KEYNOTE-189, and we are not quite sure whether this is related to the pembrolizumab or to the pemetrexed. Personally, I know from Paramount that the long-term use of pemetrexed is associated with a decrease of the renal function. And perhaps there is some additive impact on renal function by the use of pembrolizumab.
When you see this, like when in the time course, is it usually right after you start therapy or later on?
It's later on. So you see it normally after 4, 5, or 6 injections.
This concludes our program. We should note that subsequent to recording these discussions, nivolumab was approved for patients with metastatic small cell lung cancer with progression after platinum-based chemotherapy and at least one other line of treatment. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Lung Cancer Update.